Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is nestled near Philadelphia and closer still to King of Prussia. And if you don't know King of Prussia, that's probably because you're not from Philadelphia. I have talked with people from across the country, from Florida to Alaska on this podcast who have run for office at various levels, from mayor and judge to even members of Congress. But today is a particularly timely episode with someone who I'm very excited to speak with, a new state representative, new-ish, I guess, Anna Eskamani. She is an Iranian-American from Florida who won in 2018 and was not shy about her beliefs, was not shy about who she was, ran a very bold campaign and continues to legislate as a bold leader in Florida, which is always known as a swing state, always known as a state that where anything can happen. So we just get right into it. Anna, thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, Tony. It's great to be here.
So I had gone back and forth with your staff person over the last few weeks, which, first of all, one of the weird things about being in office is that you have a staff person, right?
True. And what's funny is that if I'm the one who schedules things, I somehow like always mess it up. So it's such great support. I'm very, very lucky to have a great team.
Yeah, I had a number of people I've talked to on this podcast where I say, oh, the representative or the so-and-so has said they'll do the podcast. And they're like, they said what? Okay.
I love it. I love it. That's awesome.
So we were going back and forth. And of course, your staff, very nice, as most people are that do this. And she was saying, oh, here are the issues we're most concerned with that we're focusing on. And we will talk about those in terms of school, making sure everyone can go to school and it's equality for education, the environment, women's rights. But then something big happened yesterday, and it really pertains to you more than any person I've talked with on this, including members of Congress. Is the strike against an Iranian leader, and you yourself are Iranian American, so you've been talking about this today. Do you want what should I know?
That's such a great question. It's definitely it's a very scary time. I think it's important that listeners realize how serious this most recent escalation between our two governments, the United States and the Islamic Republic of Iran, really is. It can't even be compared to other types of missions led by the United States, in the sense that the general that was assassinated not only was a leader of horrific acts of terrorism really across the world, but he was also very closely aligned to the supreme leader of Iran. So this could be comparable to the assassination of a vice president, to provide more context. And it will have repercussions around the entire region, not just in Iran. And I'm very, very concerned for the safety of U.S. troops and U.S. officials across the Middle East and North Africa region, as I am concerned about the potential of escalation towards war directly impacting innocent civilians in countries like Iraq and Iran. And in my case, I have a great deal of family in Iran. So very, very concerned about their safety and about a future of peace but in this volatile region, but also between our people.
Yeah, I have been looking at different takes online, and I don't know if you're very active on Twitter. So am I, and it seems to me that social media is terrible a lot of the time.
That's a mild way to put it.
So there are a lot of people who I know and like are like, oh, it's just a tit for tat. They struck down drones. They did this. This is a retaliation. Almost like not a big deal, just punch for punch. But for me, having lived through, well, I didn't participate in it, but watching the last Iraq war happen and watching everything else, it seems like, you know, there's real lives at stake. This seems much more serious than anything that's happened in a while.
I would agree with that. And I think that the maximum pressure campaign led by the Trump administration has never had a tangible end in sight. And I think that's been the concern for many of us who are advocates for soft power, for a peaceful path, for diplomacy, is that when you have escalation with no timeline or goal, rather, then it creates an extremely dangerous situation where there continues to be retaliation between both parties. And I want to be clear, there are bad actors everywhere. I mean, the reality is that the Islamic Republic of Iran is an oppressive government, and one that it does not democratically represent the needs of the people of Iran. But the path to war does not secure a democratic Iran whatsoever. And as we've seen in invasion of other parts of this region, to your point, the outcome is dangerous. The outcome results in lives being lost, American lives being lost, and it's incredibly expensive, with no real tangible positive goal in mind. So I think that we should all be very concerned. We should be engaged. We should be advocating to our members of Congress on this. You know, and I'm actively not only having conversations with our constituents, but also with my family in Iran. And the rumors in Iran are just swirling right now of what could potentially happen. But the one commonality we see time and time again is de-escalation and the desire to not go to war.
And, you know, you talk about the people in Iran and that it would hurt the chances for a democratic Iran. One of the things I saw was that someone was saying this will become a martyr incident for people there. And there has been this push for democracy, for modernization in different ways, and that this could be the thing that really turns the tide in the opposite bad direction in there. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, I think the reality is that hardliners in any political system want conflict, because it and you see this actually in North Korea right now, where Kim Jong-un is actually intentionally escalating because domestically it's politically smarter to do that, which the argument has been made that President Trump is doing the same thing. And so I think hardliners want this type of escalation because it feeds into their, in the case of the Islamic Republic of Iran, it feeds into their anti-American sentiment, which is not shared by the people of Iran, without a doubt. I mean, we just saw 3 weeks ago people of Iran hitting the streets, demanding rights, demanding economic relief from their government. And in 2009, we saw protests over undemocratic elections. But I will say, within the country of Iran, there are tensions and factions, and I get worried because I don't think U.S. officials making decisions are surrounding themselves by folks who speak Farsi, who have roots in Iran, who understand the potential nationalism in Iran, and there very well could be even a sort of civil war in Iran over time because of this type of escalation. So very concerning. There's so much uncertainty out there, and I'm very hopeful to see leadership from members of Congress, because I think that's the guidance we need, is that we need debate. We need consensus being built. And President Trump acts in such a unilateral way where these brass decisions are made with little oversight and little thought to retaliation, where now concern is grounded in how are Americans going to leave these countries and evacuate for the potential of their lives being at risk? What are we doing to mitigate the potential growth of xenophobia here in this country towards people who look like me because of this type of escalation?
Yeah, I mean, for not just how in terms of long term, but like literally how can they leave Iraq when they bomb the airport? Right? Like,
right.
That's not like it's an easy, I mean, someone said it's got to be very hard to get out of there when you can't leave Iraq by going through Iran and can't leave by going through, like, there's like one dirt. I don't know. It just sounds very scary for anyone who's American or American supporter in that area right now.
Totally. Yep, absolutely. It's it's very concerning. And to your point, I think there's just so much disinformation out there too that makes the situation even more complicated. And I do encourage listeners to look towards the experts, right? I'm following several journalists online, folks who have years of experience researching Iran, just following what ultimately can really evolve to be propaganda for some of our own officials and folks out of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Like, I think it's so important to cut through the noise and get down to the facts and think about the history between our two countries. I saw an agitator on our Facebook page paint the picture that before the revolution, things were very peaceful in Iran, and that's not true. It's definitely not true. There was a lot of frustrations under the Shah's monarchy, and just like there was before. There was imperialism in Iran. So we can't ignore the history of influence in this region and the decades of conflict because of it. And that has to be a part of the decision-making process when dealing with governments like the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Well, the one thing that brings it back to me from the last Iraq war, which is still going on, I don't know, to everything today is that real people are involved. And I look at your campaign video and you talk about your mom and dad, how they were Iranian Americans who met in Orlando, right?
Yep.
And
came to different parts of Iran and met here.
And when I look at the video, you talk about that, how they came here very quickly, but it really goes more to the humanity, especially your mother's story with cancer, which is really sad, and how young you were. But, you know, you go quickly there to, you're talking about these aren't Iranians, they're not Americans, they're not, this or Muslim or Christian. You're talking about people as people throughout everything in your policies and campaign from what I see.
Totally. No, I mean, we work really hard as an Orlando native who grew up in a culturally diverse home, who grew up in a culturally diverse community, being oftentimes the only Iranian American in the classroom over my young adult life, grew up to really embrace diversity and to find a commonality between us. And I'm really proud of our efforts to never shy away from who we are, but to also be able to draw connections between my story as a daughter of immigrants, to those of folks who are of multiple generations, to those who are immigrants today. And I can't tell you how many moments, someone would share with me, like, my mom was an immigrant, or I remember my grandfather's stories of being an immigrant, or I went to school with an Iranian, or my first boss was Iranian, and do you make a tagi, or, where can I find masak khiyar, just, like, all the common spaces, whether it's over food, music, dance, experiences that we can connect on. And we actually hosted the first Nowruz party in the Florida capital. Nowruz is the Iranian New Year, and it's a really important holiday, and it has many parts to it, including jumping over fire. And we brought this celebration to Tallahassee, and 150 people attended, 15 lawmakers, including 3 Republicans. And that's really important to me because it's about breaking the stigma and the barriers in ways that we can, with the hope that when my colleagues run for Congress one day, and I'm sure many will, they're going to think about the people of Iran, not just the agitation of the government. And they're going to hopefully make decisions that are thoughtful to that reality, pushing towards peace first over all other options.
And not just pushing for peace in international diplomacy, which, as a state representative, typically that's not why you ran. That's not the things you care about.
Absolutely. But also domestically, too, right?
Right.
Yeah, and challenging things like the travel ban, which has made life really hard for Iranians. And actually, though I am a state lawmaker, because of my personal story, we attract hundreds of messages from Iranians asking for help. I actually just had an Iranian email me and call me from Iran 3 days ago because he wishes to pursue a PhD program in Florida. And so, you know, I'd sent him the links to universities or national application pages. I'm very limited what I can do to help this young man, but there's this deep desire from Iranians to see the world and to engage in democratic processes and to, you know, really be able to have experience that they can bring back to Iran or create new lives in countries like ours. But a travel ban makes that really, really difficult. You hear stories from families across the United States that are divided and separated from their elders or from their children, from their siblings, because of these type of policies.
And you weren't able to do this before you were representative. Like, you could help people, but now people come to you. You know, I'm encouraging people to run for office because of the possibilities you have at any level of government, from borough council member like me to a senator. How's that feel as a human being, that people reach out to you and you're able to, if not help, but connect them to help? It can be overwhelming, but really rewarding too, right?
Correct. You summed it up so perfectly, Tony. It is, it's very humbling, but it's a lot of pressure. Actually, the Friday before, oh no, I'm sorry, the Sunday before Christmas, I was able to respond to a constituent email about a homeless individual who lives at a gas station in our district, and I really want to make sure I make contact with him before the holidays. And so I made the time on a Sunday. I went out there. It was raining. And I saw this individual. I wasn't sure if he was the one person I was looking for, but I went up to him and asked him, you know, hi, is your name so-and-so? And, you know, I was able to get his contact information, and now we're doing our best to get him an ID back and get him into a home. But, you know, the situations of that we face in constituent casework is very diverse. It's stories like that to criminal justice situations where we have family members and incarcerated calling us. We have letters from those who are incarcerated to people applying for scholarships, people lacking healthcare access, to some of these more complex international issues. And it becomes a challenge. And the parts that I hate the most about this work is when I can't help someone, right? Because the system isn't built to be helpful, or they don't meet the financial criteria, or you have policies like the travel ban. I mean, it can also be really frustrating. But again, that's why you run for office, is that you can help improve these systems, help government work for people, connect the dots, you know, dismantle the silos, get people the care they need and deserve. You know, we were successful in helping a veteran find an apartment after he was homeless for 4 months. So you have those success stories that kind of keep you fueled and motivated. But in a state like Florida, especially, every day is a challenge. Every day is a challenge. But, you know, I am a resilient person. I come from struggle. So I wouldn't have this work. I was made for this work. But it's constantly just a test of your resilience and focus.
Now, I want to think about the focus of what got you to run for office, which is the reason for the podcast. You were very involved with Planned Parenthood before this, and
yeah.
I feel like, so I'm a straight white male, age 18 to 45, as Homer Simpson would say. And so, you know, I just feel like, you know, I could go through life not voting and the world would be fine for me. You know, but I feel like when you're, one, a woman, which is half the population, two, an immigrant, three, from Iran, and have these other issues, your life is inherently political. Does that ring true?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the personal is political. Even if you don't realize it, there's almost no choice but to be political.
So, and a lot of things had happened in the couple years before you decided to run, both personally, many years before with your mom, with the Trump administration. With what were the things that really made you say, "I'm going to do this"?
definitely grounded in my love for my community, which at the time was being represented by an incumbent Republican who took no action after the Pulse nightclub tragedy took place in our district as well, where 49 mostly queer black and brown people were murdered by gun violence. Knowing my mom's story, experiencing my mom's story as one of her primary caretakers or caregivers during her last days is also foundational to me. And the trauma that I carry, the chip on my shoulder, has given me a great deal of empathy for others who are going through a struggle, for others who face the challenges of navigating the healthcare system. It's very much a part of who I am. And when Trump won his election, that was a catalyst for me, because I realized pretty quickly that nothing would change unless more everyday people ran for office. Because when you have different perspectives, when you have various levels of income, of culture, of gender, of sexuality, of disability status, serving in public office, you'll have better policy, because you're going to have policy that is thoughtful and is intentional, policy that considers unintended consequences, policy that considers an economic structure that allows us to eliminate wait lists for people with disabilities and affordable housing dollars. Because when you have folks that know how expensive healthcare can be or have struggled to pay rent on time, that helps then fuel policy that can improve the lives of folks who face those struggles. And one recent example is paid parental leave, which the federal government has signed a bill that provides an extension of paid parental leave for federal workers. And we have a bill in Florida to expand it for all workers. And you're seeing some states across the country do similar legislation. And that's often, across bipartisan lines, because you have more women in office, more women who have experienced a lack of balance in being able to provide the postnatal care for themselves and their child after giving birth. And then you have more dads who also want to have that experience and support their partners in that way. And of course, you also see different types of family structures that are adopting children who need that time to focus on early education and early upbringing. So again, that diversity in electing more everyday people, more diverse people, it'll then take shape in proactive policy that makes life better for everyone.
And I was talking to a lot of different people who've run for office in the country. There's only one state that has majority female legislature.
That's right. Yeah. Is it, can you remind me, is it Arizona? What state was that?
Close. Nevada. You're right.
Nevada. Yep. That's what it was. Yeah. It really is shocking.
And that's new. And it's not like it's been like that forever.
Totally. Well, and I want to be clear too, to listeners, I am so grateful to our allies like you. I mean, it was my AP government teacher, Mr. Norris, who got in my public school, who got me back into politics. And he is absolutely like a middle-aged, white dad.
Oh man, I feel old
he's
now.
Amazing. And he is one of my biggest cheerleaders. And actually was just re-endorsed for 2020 by our teachers union. And I mentioned him in our press release that I, sent in the article, and he was so flattered and so honored. It's like, no, I'm honored that you were part of my life. And so I think it's so important that, in our collaboration to make the state and the country and the world a better place, we have to, we can't be divided. I think it's important to, be your authentic self. Mm-hmm. But to also embrace others in that conversation and make sure no one feels like they can't play a role, in this future.
Well, and speaking of being your authentic self, I was going to ask another question, but you reminded me of something that I was really interested in talking about with you. Don't have to go long, but you ran in a district that had been Republican. And when you look at your bio, you look at the things you talk about, you're not Republican light. You're not, well, I'm a Democrat because I got to win the election or whatever. You are not shy about what you believe, right? Was that something you made a cognizant effort to do, or is
Well, I'll tell you that you know, we were told by many not to do that, whether they were consultants or even Republican colleagues who wanted me to win. I remember being advised that I should, you know, run to the left for your primary and then go towards the middle for the general. And I was like, no, like, I can't be two different people in one, you know, it's just, it's,
right.
It made no sense to me. I have to be myself. And so, but the beauty about being myself is that I am a kind person, and I want to work with Republicans when possible. I will never sacrifice my values, but I know all too well, Tony, the fights in Florida, they're less partisan and more crony capitalism. And we have Republicans in our district who hate the fact that corporations control so many of the decisions, that that war is something facilitated in many cases by those who profit from it. I mean, you know, we have folks who served in the military who might lean Republican on some issues, but definitely don't want war, and you know, have opinions about the improvement of government institutions that we can agree on. So I think part of being a strong Democrat is inclusivity. And that means inclusivity to your friends and your constituents and your colleagues who are of a different political persuasion. And the art of finding common ground is one that requires you to swallow your pride. And I feel really blessed, honestly, for the moments where that happens. It was so funny, you know, not to go back to the Iran situation, but obviously a lot of social media attention. You mentioned that already. And there was someone who commented on my personal Facebook page and called me a moron and, you know, had some comment around and called me moron. And I ignored his insult towards me. And I just responded to his question and, you know, he thanked me for my response, you know, shared something else. I thanked him for his response. I shared something else. At the end of the conversation, he blessed my family and, you know, wished my family safety in this tension. He is a Trump supporter. I don't know who he is, but I could tell from his Facebook profile. And what a beautiful moment of de-escalation, of, you know, of trying to just stay calm in situations of intense stress and sensationalism. And I do think it's up to elected officials of any political party to model that behavior. And I'm not saying I'm perfect at it, but it is a constant practice that I am proud to do. And we need more of it.
And, you know, it's easier. One, that kind of escalation is directed towards people like you, you know, not just people who are immigrants, but women. Like, I don't get people saying sexist remarks against me. Like,
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. I was having that conversation earlier today with a colleague about this too, of how you know, it definitely becomes, I think, easier for people to attack women and women of color in a more vitriolic way than they would their male counterparts. In fact, I would say our biggest online agitators are all men. And they display pattern behavior that is consistent with oftentimes being misogynistic or being dismissive of me, despite my academic credentials, my professional credentials. It does not matter to them. So it is very much a constant just reminder that for women in particular, nothing has ever been easy. Women were not given the right to vote. We protested and organized for the right to vote. And even after then, women of color were denied access because of Jim Crow laws. So it just becomes very, very apparent that that we have to be resilient. We have to support one another, and not lose sight of what really matters. And I shared this on social media yesterday too, when there was a moment of yelling back and forth between two folks, you know, on this issue with Iran. And I just commented and I said, everyone, please take a deep breath. This issue is complicated and bigger than all of us. Breathe and reboot.
Right.
And, you know, and you saw the more Republican-leaning individual like that comment. And so, you know, I think, again, like, we can lead by example, but it definitely is a test of our resilience And like I said, I have not been perfect, but I keep trying to remind myself of that. And, you know, really embody Mr. Rogers in these moments and, you know, try to express that positive energy so there can be a healthy debate versus just a back and forth argument.
Well, and I feel like men really need to step up and be better role models, both for each other and for their kids. I mean, I have a soon-to-be 6-year-old, and just the videos he watches, aww, you know, he's really good at all this stuff, and they teach kids really well at the youngest age about consent and, you know, touching, but and language, but, like, the videos he watches just of cartoons. Like, wow, I can't believe they're talking about women this way in cartoons.
Totally.
Which means they were doing it when I was a kid, and I just didn't realize it.
Well, and it reminds me of Mr. Rogers, right? I mean, one of his, you know, people would call him radical on his mission of on television to, you know, provide an alternative experience through the medium of television to children. And those reminders are so necessary, and for all of us to practice that each day, whether in small or big ways, is truly transformational.
So, I do want to touch on very quickly. You actually are working on real legislation in Florida. So, what are a couple briefly, because I know your time, I really appreciate the time you've given me. What are one or two things you're focused on that you want to accomplish in 2020 in Florida?
Sure. The two that I'll lift up are priorities, but I will say we're fighting for everything in Florida, whether it's affordable housing, mental health funding, maintaining the recent increase we successfully established with arts and culture funding, reducing wait lists for those with intellectual disabilities, and also criminal justice reform. So folks can definitely visit our member page on myfloridahouse.gov and see everything that we're fighting for. The two bills I'll lift up, one is House Bill 97 that focuses on renewable energy, and Florida setting a goal to be 100% renewable energy based by 2050, something that half a dozen cities in our state have already done, but we have yet to pursue any type of portfolio for renewable energy. So this is our second year following that bill. We're hoping for bipartisan support this session. We're really fighting for it aggressively. And the second bill is focused on prohibiting LGBTQ and disability discrimination within any school that receives public money. So Florida has an ever-growing voucher system. The state actually just created a new voucher system last session that we voted against that would pulling money out of traditional public schools towards private schools that have no regulation, no accountability. These schools are free to discriminate against children who are gay, their parents who might be LGBTQ, and also kids with disabilities or kids who might realize that they have a disability. And we think that's inappropriate. We don't think the state should use public taxpayer money to subsidize discrimination. So we have filed a bill to prohibit that as well.
Yeah, I really appreciate that bill in particular. I don't know if my son's going to grow up, you know, either my sons being gay or bi or whatever, and it doesn't matter if they're my sons or not, like, no one should be treated that way, but I really appreciate you adding in disabilities there. I work with people with disabilities. It's important to me for a lot of reasons, and I feel like that issue is getting more attention than it has since the ADA passed when you were born, because you're young.
Totally.
So finally, the podcast is called You Should Run. You have a story about being yourself. You have a really inspiring background, but not everyone has this. Obviously, not everyone has the same background. That'd be weird. But why should more people run for office, especially state legislatures, in 2020?
We need more everyday people to engage in the process and run for office, because that will create a more thoughtful, intersectional, and vibrant democracy for all. And so no matter what your background is, no matter if you think you can raise the money or not, to talk to mentors, to look towards other campaigns, to volunteer on campaigns this cycle to help you prepare to run for office. That's what really makes this country so incredible, is that someone like me, a working class daughter of immigrants, can throw her name in the hat to run for office and actually win and serve the public in a meaningful way and find common ground across political lines to do what's right for her community. And that is possible in this country. So to be courageous in making that decision, to do it within your personal time frame. Don't feel pressure by others. Do what you think is right for you and your family and your community. But if you are fearful of losing, don't let that be a reason that you don't run.
Right. And because if you might lose, but you might win, even if it's a tough race, right? And
totally.
And totally. You're not going to win if you don't run.
It's worth the risk. Absolutely. It's worth it all.
Well, thank you so much, Anna. I really appreciate all the time you're giving me, and I know that you have a very busy schedule in Florida. I wish you luck in Florida. I wish all of us luck in Florida, actually.
thank you, Tony. Right back at you. I appreciate the opportunity, and let's make it a good year.
And if people are listening and they want to learn more about you and follow you, let them know how they should get in touch with you on social media, and be kind.
Absolutely. Yeah. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and YouTube. It's Anna for Florida. Two N's, all spelled out. So definitely follow us and keep in touch.
Great. Well, follow Anna. She's definitely worth a follow, whatever state you're in or whatever country you're in. And maybe you'll be inspired by her story, and maybe you'll run for office as well. Please share this podcast, recommend your own guests, and let's work for this country together. Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you. Take care.